Okay, today is the last day of January. January 31st, 2014. The way this January's gone, I think everybody's happy to see it go. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm here with Alderman David Ahrens. And we are here on the fourth floor of the City County Building here in downtown Madison. David, for sound quality purposes, could you say your last name and spell?
Yeah.
Say your name, spell your last name.
David Ahrens, A-H-R-E-N-S.
That looks really good. I'm just going to take a quick peek here and see what we have. Yeah, I think that's going to work just fine.
Mm-hmm.
David, as I was saying before we turned the recorder on, why I'm interested in you is your involvement in the 2011 protests, but since I have you here, I want to get a little context to your life, and particularly your life on campus. So, from what I found out about you, you've been in town for 30-plus years.
Right.
So let's ask a first question. What brought you to Madison?
I came here to go to graduate school. I was a late graduate student. Prior to coming to graduate school, I had worked for different unions for 3 or 4 years on the East Coast and in the D.C. area and San Francisco. And decided I would like and could benefit from getting a graduate degree in labor relations. And at the time, Madison had probably the, not the premier school, but the, probably the second most credited and established, well-established schools in labor relations. It was called the Institute for Research and IRRI, the Institute for...
Was poverty in it? Was it, was poverty?
No, poverty, was, poverty wasn't in it.
So
anyway, it was a labor relations school, and it had been around since John Commons and so on. And so I got lucky to get a scholarship there, and so I decided this was... the place to be. I part of the scholarship, though, was at the same time as my that I went to school, I began working for the AFSCME, that's County and Municipal Employees Council here, and really after a year or so. My attention to school really started to wane as my sort of integration with the goings on at the union level increased. So I really didn't, you know, I was one of those people who took all my classes either on a Monday or Wednesday or a Tuesday or Thursday to limit the amount of time that I had to spend on campus. But I got a degree after all was said and done. And then immediately began working for AFSCME, sort of the day after graduation.
Okay.
I became a labor relations rep.
Okay. If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind backing up a little bit. You said you'd worked in unions prior to coming to graduate school. So when did you begin wanting to be involved in unions?
I started working for a union in 1976 in Baltimore. Actually, at the time, I was working in the Baltimore Personnel Department and doing personnel work, not labor relations. Personnel, so it was a substantive difference. And it was one of those things that were kind of clicks in your mind and you sort of happens and you ask a lot of fundamental questions. What happened there was a layoff within the personnel department. And in those days, this is 1976, the five oldest people in the department were fired. And including, you know, people who I had professional and personal relationships with. And I was a young guy, I was 20-something years old, and I was just shocked and outraged that they fired the five oldest people. And there was no age discrimination law in those days. And I said, well, what should I do about it? Well, I'll call a union. I was pretty naive. And so I remember I called the auto workers union. It was the only union that I could think of at the time. And then they, I said, boy, we need a union here, and the auto workers ought to get over here quickly, and because people all over this, you know, city employment are upset. And they handed my number off over to someone from the County and Municipal Employees Union in Maryland at the time, and they handed my number off to somebody else in the union, and I met with these people from the National Union, and I must have seemed like a really gung-ho kind of guy. And they said, well, why don't you come over and work with us? And I mean, it was just completely caught me like out of the blue. I wasn't thinking about that. We'll pay you the same thing. Tell me what these other people pay. Baltimore pays you. We'll do you the same. And we'll give you some training and spread the gospel. You know, you got the message, and so I did. And though I did a little work in Baltimore, I soon became an international rep, which means I traveled through a 3 or 4 state area and around the D.C. sort of huge metro area, Virginia, West Virginia, Delaware, Maryland. And did work on organizing campaigns and strikes. Those were the days before most places had collective bargaining, and people struck to get collective bargaining rights, and or even absent of collective bargaining, struck for pay anyway, even though there was no union, and the union would be involved with that. So many of those places had no, as we say, no law or very minimal rights to situations where there was a full labor relations statute and process in play, like we used to have here. So it was quite a whirlwind experience for a young man. My first day on the job, I remember, I went with the guy who was my boss, and we went to a negotiation, and the negotiation was 18 hours long. And it was just an amazing process. It was the last day of what had been months of negotiations, and the last session was from like 10 in the morning to 4 o'clock in the morning. And the guy who I was working with was a old guy, probably older than I am now. And I remember coming into our caucus room, and he at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was doing push-ups to... to stay awake and alert. So that was quite a process. So anyway, stayed with them for about 2 years or so, and for personal reasons, you know, girlfriend, I moved out to California and got a job working as a banquet waiter, but soon became very involved in the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union in San Francisco, which at the time was going through a revolutionary, truly a revolutionary change. It had been under the thumb of the same leadership for over 30 years. Of course, San Francisco had changed in the past 30 years. And the union was very mob-oriented, shall we say. Both the San Francisco and the Las Vegas locals. Las Vegas was Local 1, San Francisco was Local 2. So, I mean, these were long-standing unions of very big unions, very big locals. And there had been there was a grassroots campaign to change over what was a very sclerotic leadership that had been in place for, as I said, for 30 years. And the campaign was just, I was very lucky in that I came in when it was, I mean, I didn't have to, I was not involved with building it. I came in when it was well established. And it was remarkable. I mean, we printed a newspaper in four languages every month. I mean, and it was a newspaper in English, Spanish, Tagalog, and Chinese. And so the process, I mean, we organized in every hotel. It was mostly hotels, big hotels and long-established restaurants. Was a long process. I mean, and finally we had, the election had to be supervised by the Department of Labor because of all the problems with the hotel and restaurant workers nationally at the time. So our lawyers went to court and demanded federal oversight of the election. And the elections took place were 3 days, 24 hours a day, because everybody worked shifts all through the day and night. And so I was the monitor. I was the chief monitor for our side on the election. And unfortunately, they forced us to have only one location for the whole city. So here you had, it was 17,000 members of the local, one location in the city. And 10,000 people cast ballots. We really got people to understand. People understood really, by virtue of their workplace, this is really important. You better vote. It's more important than a presidential election or anything else. You better vote. Also, of course, many of these people couldn't vote in a presidential election. But anyway, people came after their shift at 11 to 7 as, you know, night cooks or cleaners and hotels, and came down to, I forget what street it was, and voted. We had, on the last day, we had dragon dances in the street, you know, for the Chinese folks, and Tagalog drum bands, Filipino drum bands, and it was fantastic. And we won. But the downside of the story was that we were soon put in what's called trusteeship by the National Union. And then that led to a whole series of federal court cases and redo elections. The people in Las Vegas also won, and they were all killed. And that, for our guy who was our president, he just couldn't handle it. And when they were killed, he just couldn't handle it and was hospitalized. I mean, he just really mentally became unhinged. And that gave part of the cause for the National Union to say that the leadership was unable to implement contracts and so on. Mm-hmm. It was really a... So after, you know, a month out, we were then in the trusteeship, and then it just became, when you get too involved in all this litigation stuff and so on, it just strips all the power from members. You say, well, we're in court. Why aren't we the leaders anymore? Why is these, mob guys from Washington now at our meeting again? Blah, blah, blah. And it's just all kind of mystifying to people who are not used to those kinds of processes, and they have really no say. I mean, basically, so there's nothing we can do. Well, we can protest that, and we're sending our lawyers, but in terms of what do we do at the workplace, what's different, let's try to be more aggressive, but still the leadership will stop it. Mm-hmm.
So was it around this time that you started looking for...
Right.
something different.
Something different, yeah. Okay. And so then I decided to... I was pretty burnt out, and people were, as you can imagine, somewhat discouraged at that. I mean, I just saw this going on and on, and it did. It just went on in court battles and redo elections and so on for years. So then I came here. So I got a scholarship here through AFSCME and went to school and...
So you said
union representation work.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So you said that in your mind this was the second best school for labor relations.
Yeah, Cornell is sort of the premier. It's a big school. It's in fact has status as a school where we had this was an institute. It was Industrial Relations Research Institute.
Yeah, we did.
That's what it's called. And so it's you know the scope of it was smaller.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you find out about it?
Oh, it's a well-known
okay.
school. I mean, I think if you're at the time in 1980 or 79 or something, the Wisconsin, I mean, it's the great Wisconsin School of Economics, and it's closely related to the econ department. Most of the real faculty for the labor relations, they were housed in the econ department.
Okay. So how was your, pretty broad question, but your adjustment to Madison? I assume this was your first time. Was this your first time in Madison when you came
First
here?
Time in the Midwest, yeah. Right. It was quite an adjustment. I mean, I'd come from San Francisco and San Francisco, and I go back often because my family lived there. It was a different city then, of course, and it was much more diverse city. I mean, there actually were lots of Chinese and Filipino and so on, Latinos living in the city and workplaces. And that's really the people who I worked with. And then I came here, and this city at the time was probably like 95% white. And before San Francisco, I lived in Baltimore and worked there, which was a majority black city. Mm-hmm. And doing union work, everybody I worked with was black because it was for unskilled trades, you know, unskilled workers. I mean, I was organizing garbage collectors, and that was sort of the main stock of people who I worked with, garbage list, sewer workers, water workers, street department people. And so coming to Madison, which was at the time, just I remember driving into town and I could not believe all the white people. I mean, I should have figured that this was going to be all white people. And, you know, so I sort of had this map and I drove up to the university, and it was just all white people. And so that was strange. But school was really, I think you'll find that it's a problem for, it can be a problem for people who have been in the field to then go study the academic version of what their experience is. Now, the academic version may be, in a generalizable sense, true, but there's definitely going to be dissonance between one's specific experiences and that academic version of it. Mm-hmm. So I took a class in collective bargaining and negotiations, and there just seemed to be a quite a dissonance and big difference between what the professors were teaching and what my 4 or 5 years of experience was. Also, I only had one professor who ever ever had any actual experience in collective bargaining, and that had been just for two or three years, decades before. Mm-hmm. That was a disadvantage. I really believe it was a disadvantage.
So your background made you feel like it was a disadvantage?
I felt like I know all this stuff. And I even knew some of the academic aspects of it. It's, you know, read a little of the literature while I was actually working in it. But looking back at it, I felt like, gee, if I had come in like the other graduate students, most of whom were just coming directly from undergraduate school, they just have sort of this open mind about it. And, you know, the teacher tells, you know, this is how things are, these are the facts, and so on. Mm-hmm. This is how collective bargaining works. You can read on page 200 to 244. And people take it at its word. And I would be, you know, in the class raising my hand and saying, well, but what about, and have, you know, just being a kind of disagreeable person that I am, that always sometimes worked against me. Felt that things would have went smoother and easier if I had just gone into collective bargaining and labor relations the same way that I went into my statistics course. I really had no point of view going into my stats course.
So did you seek out union work before you started school or here?
Yeah.
So did you already have something set up?
I knew I'd be working with an AFSCME group of some kind. And I started working for the county municipal employees and more or less stayed with them for 7 years, yeah.
So you had the, and you've already talked about this, but I'll comment and see what, it sounds like you had the sort of the double disadvantage of being a non-traditional student in terms of age.
Yeah, so I was older than cohort, folks. Yeah.
Cohort-wise, you know, you're off age, and then you had practical experience where the rest of them, at least it sounds like for the most part, the rest of the students and even most of the faculty didn't have sort of practical labor relations.
Right. I was sort of surprised, really, that I was the only person. There was one other guy who was my age, maybe a little older, who had been a personnel officer for X number of years and was going back to school. But other than that, it was almost, I think, 100% of the people were just coming out of undergraduate school. I thought it would be like people going back to school to get a master's degree in education, where there'd be a lot of people who had been in the classroom, or RNs getting a master's degree in nursing or something. Mm-hmm. Because it's UW, even though most of the people, this was, as they say, their terminal degree, they still wanted people to, encourage people to go and become academics and get a PhD. So there was always a certain percentage of people sort of after the first year that would either, you know, chose to or encouraged to continue into a doctoral program, which I had no interest in doing.
Let's sort of back up. What part of town did you, when you got here, what part of town did you live
in? I lived on the east side, primarily. I lived with um, someone who is in the doctoral department, in the economics department, who's getting his PhD in economics. The economics department in those days, and I'm sure it's not at all anymore. There was a famous economist here, John Commons, who's turn of the century person, who did little things like unemployment compensation, workers' compensation, those social revolutions. He was really the initiator, the architect of many of those programs, developed an academic basis for it, but was obviously a doer and worked on implementing those at the state level. And Wisconsin was the first state to implement both of those programs. And he was the chair of the economics department. Well, as a sort of from the Commons tradition, one part of the Commons tradition, I should say, is what's called institutional economics. And that is, I'm going to define that. It's almost defined as what it's not now. That is, it's these are not quantoids. You know, there's of course, they have to use quantitative analysis in terms of doing, studying an issue like wage levels and employment levels as a result of unemployment compensation. But they're not statisticians necessarily, and or econometricians. And really, that's sort of the avenue that where the department became. But my roommate friend for those years was in the PhD program, and of course he had a quantitative background, and but he was involved in labor economics, which was a good part of the econ program in those days, as you get a PhD in labor econ. And now he's the head of the Economic Policy Institute, and has been really functionally, in terms of economic policy, the leading labor economist in the country, other than maybe someone at the Department of Labor. But they graduated many of the people who at the time worked as labor economists for various unions or the remaining universities that wanted a labor economist, understanding really how labor markets operate.
So was this, to get back to it then, was this disadvantage you had, was that part of the reason why, or one of the reasons why school became not necessarily less of a priority, but you sort of focused your time in school for certain periods and then spent the rest of the time?
School was sort of the unreal world, and just sort of I felt by the second year I was just getting my ticket punched and wanted to get back to things that really happened to people. My roommate in the PhD program, and he also had, in between undergraduate and graduate school, he had worked for UAW and someplace else. So he had had institutional experience in understanding how labor relations functions.
So then you came here in the early 80s.
79 was, how do you remember these things? I remember when Reagan won, and I watched the results with other staff from the union. Mm-hmm. And so I think I was in my second year then. I don't think I would have been there right when I started. So I probably started in 79.
So this is a general statement, but so, except for the time you were on campus earning your master's degree, mm-hmm. did you have much involvement with either campus activism or labor issues on campus?
Well, the TAA strike occurred in 81. And it's funny, because I had a fellowship, I was given an office. there. And and I really didn't use the office. I mean, I had an office at the union, so I didn't really. I mean, for people who are RAs and working for professors and so on, office made sense, but I really didn't need one. So I used it to study as my place to study and do work. And the guy who's in the office right next to me was the president of the TAA, David Hecker, and he had the loudest voice. He must have had like hard of hearing parents or something. But if he was on the phone, it would be it would be so loud, and these were like these cement block walls at the social science building. It was so loud. So I used to hear sort of like the day-to-day events of what was happening leading up to the TAA strike. So the TAA strike was a long strike, and it was, I mean, the TAA had already had recognition. I mean, so that happened many years before. And but it was ultimately unsuccessful in what they had to do, which was to shut down classes. So classes continued, especially at the undergraduate level. And they went back to work after a long period it out. But, you know, it wasn't definitional in terms of that it either caused the decline or tremendous growth in it. I mean, one of the things that it did do, and this was a problem, sort of one of these weird secondary effects, they picketed the bus, like the bus barn, or the area where buses came onto campus, like at the hospital, and the Teamsters refused to cross the line, and so there was no bus service on campus. Well, those guys lost their pay. So when the Teamsters, a half a year later, so these guys were out of work for 35 days or whatever it was. Well, shortly thereafter, the city and the Teamsters union got into this contract dispute. And a good friend of mine was an officer, president, and vice president of the bus drivers union, and and I remember having this conversation with him where he was saying that it was difficult to strike the city because so many workers, so many members had lost their pay during the TA strike that they were averse to now going out again for an interminable period of time. So it's just sort of one of these secondary effects of things that actually it turned out really to their benefit. It was a good, and what happened was, and this is really tangential, Teamsters used to have, up to that point, they had what's called a COLA agreement, which is a cost of living adjustment. So whatever the rate of inflation was, they got that plus a half a percent. And they had that for years. And they had that through a period of, through the late 70s, during Carter's last years, which was a period of terrific inflation. And of course, they loved their COLA. And, and the city wanted to buy it back from them. And they didn't want to give it up, and they were ready to strike for it. Well, but they settled instead for, and actually I negotiated the same agreement in some other place at the same time. They was I sold a cola in Racine. So I sold it for what we call three tens, 10% each year for 3 years. Well, as it turns out, inflation fell. The whole country went into a recession a year after Reagan came into office, and inflation rate was like 2 or 3%. These guys made out like bandits. If they had stuck with their cola, they'd be making 20% less money than they are now. So, but I remember I had so many meetings with these guys to encouraging them to give up their cola, because 3 10% pay hikes would bring home the bacon, and it really did. Anyway, so all these weird chain of events, the TAA strike, caused these guys to secondary picket, shut down, not strike, and they came out way ahead of the city on that as well.
But overall, at least in your opinion, the TAA strike didn't necessarily benefit the TAA, though.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No. I mean, I remember there were a number. I had differences with a number of different strategic, tactical differences with how they conducted the strike. And,
So besides the TAA strike, do you recall other? And also, again, beside the fact that you were going to school there, any other?
That really wasn't involved with campus very much. I was not part of sort of the graduate student social thing. It's a fairly small group of industrial relations students, say 40 or 50. And, I mean, they had a... You know, they're pretty group oriented, of course, and that really wasn't my social group. Because of my work with AFSCME, I was already involved with sort of other labor activists and so on campus and not on campus, in the city, and just also older people.
More of your age.
More of my age, or yeah, people who are settled, had families, and so on. I mean, my best friend, who was a student, was an Italian graduate student, and he had come on a Fulbright here to get his PhD, and he had been a substantial position. Mm-hmm. In a union in Italy for 6 years before coming here. And so, I mean, I spent time with him and his wife.
So maybe we should, sort of fast forward then.
Yeah.
Is 1996 then the next sort of time that you become involved in campus with,
yeah.
with the Cancer
mm-hmm.
Center?
Right.
So if you would mind starting by giving an overview of how that came
Yeah, about. I had, transitioned through, fast forward through some careers. So stayed with the union, went to a different union, then worked in the legislature for, on and off, for about 6 years or so. And my last 2 years at the union, I started the research office for the union, was a research director for the state union. And the union, a good part of its membership were healthcare workers, the non-professional healthcare workers who worked in county and nonprofit nursing homes and hospitals. So as a result of that, I became very knowledgeable and involved with how healthcare is funded, and healthcare financing. And so, for personal reasons, I had married a labor arbitrator, and it really became it was not feasible for me to be as a union advocate with my wife as an arbitrator, who was hearing cases with my union. And because the main part of my job was doing these arbitrations. So even if I of course would never do it with her, but her colleagues and so on, was an uncomfortable situation. So I had an opportunity, she didn't want to leave her position, and I had an opportunity to leave mine. So I went to work in the legislature for the health committee, and who works a lot with how healthcare is financed. Did that, but also became involved with public health issues, and particularly smoking and drinking, because the chair of the committee was a former public health nurse. And so I was her staff person for the committee. So I became involved with that. So this was just the first beginnings of smoking as a national health issue. And really, they really had very novice kind of, they being the, you know, Cancer Society, the anti-smoking groups, very novice lobbyists. And so they had convinced, through a series of things, they convinced the UW Cancer Center to get a grant that would hire some people to start a state anti-tobacco coalition and local tobacco group, anti-tobacco groups, to change local and state policies. So, given my background in public health and organizing, the Cancer Center hired me to start the organization. And I did. And worked, stayed with it for, I stayed in that organization as the director for 3 or 4 years, and then I and a faculty in the medical school wrote a grant to finance a much bigger, well-funded group, and we were funded. And then the question whether I wanted to stay with that or stay with the I could spin off and do Smoke-Free Wisconsin, which is what the organization was, or I could stay at the Cancer Center and be a researcher there in public policy, and I chose the latter.
So let's maybe delve into this for a couple of questions, and then we're probably at the wrap-up point. So first off, when you were hired to be the person in charge, where did that position you on campus?
Well, we were first off campus for two or three years. We were off campus. We were way out on Monroe Street. So, I mean, it was part of UW, but we were not on campus. And then we, I got a grant for a lot of money and needed a lot of space. And so we moved to the Wharf building.
So after the bigger grant?
Yeah, we moved to the Wharf.
Then you moved to Wharf.
Mm-hmm.
So for those first couple of years when you were on Monroe Street, it sounds like you weren't on campus, but you were sort of campus?
Yeah, what? Right. I shared an office with another cancer center group that was that was a public service group. It was called the Cancer Information Service. We had very tangential kind of relationships with the campus. And part of that was intentional. The Cancer Center, it was not, being anti-smoking then was not great PR for the Cancer Center. it was very, this was in the, you know, it's called the Carbone Cancer Center. Well, this is in the day when Carbone was alive and I knew him. And it was gutsy on his part to allow this to happen, to take on the grant, and to have an organization that said, we're part of the Cancer Center. And get into disputes with powerful interests. And so we got into disputes with retail stores, because they were selling cigarettes to kids, to restaurants, because we weren't smoking in restaurants, and so on. And he was willing to take the heat on that. I mean, they have to be involved with community fundraising. It's not all NCI, ACS money, and they're dependent on goodwill of the community. And just being open, not for the Cancer Center to be perceived as a hostile entity in any way. So he was unbelievable. I mean, he was unbelievable in terms of willing to take that on, because if you actually look through the places that were funded and where their organizational home was, very few were cancer centers. Even though it would be sort of an obvious place for them to be, there may have been two or three in the country where a cancer center was willing to take this on, because it was so unpopular.
So what, I guess I'll ask it this way, mm-hmm. although I don't know if, mm-hmm. so the first grant, the smaller of the two grants, what would you consider to be the successes that came from that?
We began the work of establishing local, viable county-based anti-tobacco groups of people who were willing to initiate or challenge public policies. Initially, the first thing was preventing youth access to tobacco. And it seems odd, but 20 years ago, that was controversial. Mm-hmm. I was thinking this the other day, how I remember being at some meeting, and it happened in the legislature. We'd have people come to the legislature and say, we should be able to sell cigarettes to kids, because if I don't, I'll take a loss. This will hurt my business. So, and legislatures would be, yeah, right, I guess, see your point of view. Yeah, I guess we shouldn't do anything about that. They're a good part of my customers. We started with real, what would seem to be easy things like that, but that's how we started, and then began issues concerning secondhand smoke. And you know, the process of educating people about that took really took about a decade.
So, was it because the first grant was running out that you looked for?
No, we just got, I got a much bigger grant to do a whole variety of research projects.
And who was the faculty that you worked with?
Pat Remington. He's the associate chancellor of the medical school now.
So, and it was that grant that moved you on the campus into the Wharf building.
Right, right.
So how did additional, I guess, were these two grants?
They were separate organizations. Okay. Yeah. My second grant was Robert Wood Johnson, and it allowed us to do a lot of, you know, interesting stuff, and then got some more money from the state. You know, that sort of then brought more money from the state, and we were, and then I directed this what we call the surveillance and evaluation project. And surveillance, this is an epidemiological term, which sounds kind of scary in these NSA days. But I mean, surveillance simply meant doing, you know, coding people's behaviors on smoking and smoking policy, exposure to secondhand smoke, and so on. So we would do both surveys and also real air testing, biomedical testing of people who are smokers or subject to secondhand smoke. And at the time, there were a number of different projects being conducted by these counties and state groups and so on, and we would do the evaluations of those operations. So, say, in the early 2000s or so, the state had dedicated quite a bit of money to running TV ads about smoking. I don't know what state were you living in the early twos?
Idaho.
So you probably didn't have it there. Yeah. but we were running a lot of millions of dollars worth of TV commercials about different aspects of smoking. And our unit did the evaluations of those commercials with youth and adults, smokers and non-smokers. And then, you know, there were just many different kinds of programs that people, most of these were, you know, pilots and experimental programs. Gee, if you do these things and have these kinds of activities for sixth graders, what happens when they're eighth graders? What happens in, if you have a smoke-free place, what happens to the number of smokers who work there? Do they give up smoking? What happens in their homes? Do they give up smoking in their homes? And, you know, those odd things happen where, because people cannot smoke in their workplace, they also give up smoking in their homes. And then, of course, after a while, you give up smoking because you're not smoking. I mean, it's just so much you could smoke in your car, and then your spouse says, stop smoking in the car. So I mean, it really pushed the area so that, you know, about, I think the last statistic that I read was like 25% of smokers or something do not smoke in their homes. So we had what was called the surveillance arm of the project, which is running a lot of mass surveys and testing, and the other part was program evaluation. The state and the federal government was spending, you know, between $15 and $20 million a year on different kinds of anti-smoking education and cessation projects. And we did the evaluations about what worked.
So I guess it sounds like to me that your activism becomes focused, at least at this part of your life, in sort of healthcare / public health. Is that a
that
an assumption, safe assumption?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is there any other, in the, I guess this takes us 90s, almost probably into the early 2000s.
Sure.
Any other activism or labor activities you're doing at that point?
No, I wasn't involved with labor work anymore. I was involved politically on campaigns. But I wasn't I wasn't central to any campaign activity, shall we say. I mean, I've been, and certainly as older, but I mean, in 1986, I was on leave from work for periods of time working on a U.S. Senate campaign, and then in 88 on a state campaign. So I wasn't at that level of activity, by far. I was what we'd call a reliable, you know, campaign helper. knew politicians because, you know, politicians want to know people who are reliable campaign helpers. But beyond that, wasn't that critically engaged. I was very absorbed by, there were a period of probably 4 or 5 years where I was very absorbed by this tobacco thing. At the time, probably from 98 to 2002 or 2003, there was really a fervent, almost religious kind of sense of mission that people had, that this, you know, evil tobacco industry that's killed blah, 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 and done all these, as you know, it's now known, horrible things, lies and deceit and so on, that we were going to, you know, slay the dragon, and perhaps if not slay it, then really shrink it in a measurable way, and we had money and resources to be able to do it, growing public support to do it, growing public understanding about what was happening, and so it was really quite, as I say, really absorbing. I mean, and the people that I worked with, being at the university, worked with, we had lots of graduate students and research assistants and graduate assistants and everything, and people came and were just like, I am so happy. I mean, they were, I mean, to have something that was like, wow, we're really changing society. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you could watch it. I mean, we'd look at the map and, oh, okay, let's put that dot on Oshkosh now. It has smoke-free restaurants. You know, let's put the dot here, you know. And so for people to be engaged at that level, and there was a lot of TV, you know, there was a lot of media attention to things, to that at the time, and but beyond that, I mean, people really had a great sense of mission on this, and I mean, it worked with a lot of kids, working with kids wasn't, you know, really my cup of tea. But for the people who were, I mean, I could see it from afar why you'd want to do it, because I'd go to youth events and high school events of kids against tobacco, whatever they were, people, you know, especially some of the, you know, younger people, graduate assistants and so on, were very turned on and lit up by that. And that really becomes contagious. I mean, it really becomes sort of a groupthink.
I want to, we've gone a little over an hour. I always try to give you the last word. We sort of did a whirlwind from 1976 Baltimore, to, you know, 2003 Madison. Is there anything on your mind specifically about those, you know, those decades that you feel you want to get on the record in case we don't get to it on the follow-up interview?
Not really. I'm trying to think about sort of the aspect of the, you know, sort of my relationship to the university. I mean, I had a, at the time, and this sort of became instructive at a later time when I became an employee advocate, I could look back and say, well, many people are of the mind that I was 5 or 6 years before, which was there a tremendous sense of mission. Funding is lush and solid for the foreseeable future. And, you know, sort of all is well. You know, I'm paid adequately. I mean, it was a... and then, you know, but then things, of course, changed, you know, over the next decade or so. So, you know, in terms of a lot of times people, when I was more involved in the union activity, people would be frustrated. And the other piece of that was, the third part of it is, and this was probably the most important part, was how cloistered I was. And this will come up more later, which is my sense of where I work was limited to the third and fourth and sixth floor of the Wharf building. That was the university. That's where my people were, and that's... that was it. And the fact that there was this big cancer center over at the Clinical Science Center, and those people at Bascom Hill, that to me was just stuff on a page. You know, there really was no kind of sense of that I was somehow really part of that other than my pay status or whatever. And that's how I think most who were not academic staff who were not administrative, but academic staff who were research people, which was most of the academic staff, they're focused on, you know, this protein. And not that other protein. They're focused on this protein, and that's how I was. You know, I mean, there was another group, Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, which took up the quarters that I left on Monroe Street, and so they moved in where I left, and of course I worked with them. But those are the clinical types. You know, those people tested medicines to help people stop smoking. And I worked with them, did some joint research projects with them. But, I mean, they were sort of in my circle, but not really of it. And I'm sure they felt the same way. was they tested drugs, and I did this public policy stuff and millions of surveys and all crazy stuff. So people have this very kind of very, very parochial view in academia, because really it's who you work with, where your money comes from. And on the research end, very, very little comes from the university. So it's very difficult to get to give people sort of some kind of broader collective view of this, that really your situation, your employment situation as a researcher in, you know, protein enlargement may be similar and so on. It's very hard. I mean, you really need a longer, broader view to be able to, and really some kind of crisis, you know, to be able to do it. And that's sort of what the question was in 2011, as to whether that crisis would precipitate both the view and then action that would flow from that. And we'll resume.
Right. We will pick up probably a few years before 2011, yeah. Okay. But thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it. Okay, today is February 4th, 2014. This is the second interview with, did you go by Dave or David?
David.
Mm-hmm. David Ahrens, and we are here inside the City County building, inside the Madison Common Council suite of offices. My name's Troy Reeves. So, David, we last left off chronologically at 2003, mm-hmm. And we just talked about that. So 2003 was just where we ended. It wasn't necessarily an end point or a changing point for you on campus.
No. But in terms of, I guess in 2005, I began working as a, functioning as a delegate to the Academic Staff Assembly. For our unit, which was the Cancer Center. And the Academic Staff Assembly is a body that's charged with, it's statutorily charged with developing and reviewing policies and procedures in employment policies and procedures in regard to academic staff. It reviews them, and that's the, it doesn't necessarily set those policies mm-hmm. and procedures. It's a review process and review and comment okay. on it.
Mm-hmm. How did you first find out about Academic Staff Assembly or ways to become involved as an academic?
I think it's
staff
part of the orientation. You get, you know, different parts of it. It's a very, I think it's quite a low profile a group, probably in within my unit. I think very few people had really heard of it. But you know, because of my background in employment relations, I was interested in that there is such a body mm-hmm. exists. So I contacted them, and they said, "Oh, please be a delegate. We haven't had a delegate from the Cancer Center for years." I began to attend those meetings, and it was as I thought, which was that it's, first of all, it's chaired by the provost. So it doesn't even have the autonomy sort of being chaired by a member of its own body. Mm-hmm. It's chaired by an official of the administration. In terms of doing employment relations, because it's academic staff, there's such huge range of academic staff that you have. I mean, when I joined it, I was what's called a research program manager. I had hired and fired, and I was a program manager. And there were many people who were very senior. There were a lot of people who were assistant deans in the leadership of the group. So really, in terms of being it couldn't really function as an advocate for employment rights for most of the academic staff, because people want to exercise their managerial authority. So it's a very mixed bag of everybody who's research assistant. I forget the classifications now, but sort of the lowest lab rat, shall we say, to my position, which was the highest research administration, research program manager 3. So it's basically it's for research programs that are more than $1 million. So that's quite a bit of latitude there. So the academic staff assembly reviewed fairly minor policies. I'd never, in the probably 4 or 5 years that I was a member of it, and I stayed as a member of it throughout UFAS and everything else, it never took a substantive critical view of an administrative policy, and this went all the way to the whole revision of the academic staff under the new human resource policies that took effect in, or almost took effect, and then were repealed in 2012. I attempt to participate in that, and then in around 2007 or 2008, I became interested in working with the union, because that is United Faculty and Academic Staff, because in 2008 the faculty and academic staff won collective bargaining rights. I think I'd been a member earlier and then left because it seemed to be just have one issue, which was to get collective bargaining rights, and until that was going to happen, there was really not much that organization can do other than work for collective bargaining rights. And as it is a pretty expensive organization to be a member of. They wanted 1% of your salary, 1% of your gross salary was the dues. So in terms of my ideological commitment, it wavered at that point. But once the collective bargaining rights were won, then it became a whole different story, which is now there's something to really do. And the whole question of collective bargaining on the campus, which had been going on for 80 years, now was past the point of discussion, and now was a point of reality. Or not reality. You're either going to do it or not. And that was true for all faculty and academic staff. The collective bargaining bill was passed as an actual bill. Along with it, however, was a series of amendments to budget bills that Let me just say, in case you haven't gotten this from other people, the model that was going to be developed was there would be separate academic staff and faculty votes on each campus. There was not going to be either cross-campus, inter-campus, or inter-academic staff. So there were going to be all separate bargaining units. Each of those units, so academic staff and faculty, say on the Madison campus, could collectively, that is, not collectively, they would both have to affirmatively vote yes to make one bargaining unit. So it looked to be a multiple bargaining units all across these many units, many different campuses. So there we were. And the second thing that happened was, and this turned out to be really momentous, was one of the budget bills included a provision that was called the, it's cumbersome language, unit clarification of the academic staff. Over the years, as new positions are created, and the university is always never destroying, but always creating new classifications and new positions, it's incumbent on the HR department to say, okay, here we have a seismic technologist, seismic technologist one, seismic technologist two, so, and so on. What bargaining unit should that person be in? Should that person be in an academic staff unit? Should that person be a technical staff that is represented by currently by a union? And if so, which union? So on. So hundreds of these things come forth. I mean, on a literally hundreds per year come forth. And the HR department puts them in these different boxes. Well, the unions have always contended that they're putting an awful lot of them in the academic staff box, which is not represented, and rarely are they put into one of their technical and clerical or scientist. AFT had a science professionals position, science professionals unit, and AFSCME had this clerical unit. It was called clerical technical, and then there was another union called the blue collar unit, which were people who do blue collar work, the sweepers and cleaners and non-skilled trades mechanics. So this was going on over years, and the AFSCME units were often crying that, you know, through attrition, their locals are getting smaller, while this academic staff unit has grown to over 8,000. Okay. And there were, you know, a lot of charts that, you know, showed this real up and sweeping curve. You know. So late in the budget process of the last budget of the Doyle era, entered an amendment that said basically that the unions can just petition for all of the people, any of the people they saw fit within the academic staff, and have them, and here's the word, accreted to their existing unit. Well, there's a process of unit clarification, and this is a study that I conducted when this came about. it's a process that can that happens in both private and public sector labor relations, and so in the public sector, you know, you have a county garage, and they hire a storekeeper. It's called a storekeeper. Is that person a management employee? Is that person a blue collar, white collar? What local union do they go to? And there's a different, if there's a difference of opinion, people would go to the WERC and you'd have a short hearing on this. Person would describe their duties, and someone from the commission would say, put it in this box or put it in that box. And these, so I went through all of the union clarification petitions ever conducted by the PERC in 10 years. And the average size of the units that were being clarified were two. Okay, it's usually one, two, three, four. Okay. Well, this was something where they were going to take about 4,000 people and assign them to a union without an election. And it's unheard of. I mean, in the private and public sector, it's simply unheard of. When you have a unit of that size, people vote. It should not just be an administrative process. And it's, I mean, in many different ways. I mean, it's anti-democratic and everything else. So a lot of people raised quite a stink about it. And Doyle said, well, he didn't mean for it to be that. I mean, I think just his democratic impulse, even though he wanted to do a favor for the unions after all those years, I think his democratic impulse was, well, of course, if you're going to have thousands of people who are in a union, they should vote to whether or not they want to join. Well, the unions didn't see it that way. The unions, in the immortal words of Marty Beale, said, I want what's mine. That was his quote in the paper. He thought that he had some legal, moral, some kind of right to just tell 1,500 people, you're now in our union, pay up. And for our purpose at in UFAS, we saw it as, well, of course, it's undemocratic. And people would be furious. And after they were furious, they would vote the union out. And when I pointed out to some of the unions that you're about to accrue so many people and they're going to be so pissed off, you'll be decertified throughout the union. So there's 200 people in the union. You're going to accrue 300 people. They could call a certification election and you're going to wind up with zero. That started to change their minds and started to, I think, cross people off of their list that they wanted to have in. Well, we got into really, that is UFAS, into really pretty heated argument with the AFT state folks because of the strategy. I mean, they just saw, you know, the opportunity to just pick off thousands of people without going through the effort, cost, whatever. It's very costly to run a certification election, run a union campaign. I mean, you have to hire these people to be organizers and do all these mailings and convince people and this whole thing. Well, through this, you just have to hire a lawyer, basically. They do the petition, they go to the hearing and argue the case. And I said that that's, well, for many of the reasons, that that's we're going to wind up either without anything because people will be so pissed, or if for some reason people don't decertify the union or vote no, we'll wind up with a very weak union. Because part of the process of organizing people and getting people engaged and building their union makes for a stronger union. And instead it was a formula for either a catastrophe or just a bad union. So they really compounded their problem. What they did then, and this was just unbelievable. Most people still didn't know what was going on with this. It hadn't gotten much publicity at all. No press publicity. It had been operating at a pretty low level of discussion, mostly between us UFAS folks and AFT and AFSCME and so on. Well, what happened is someone had contacted a Journal Sentinel or some reporter to talk about this. AFT found out that there was going to be a newspaper report about it. Not that that many people in Madison read the Journal Sentinel, right? Well, their response was so over the top. They then, that day, sent out a letter to everybody on their list of all the potential accreted individuals. I wish I had a copy of it. It was, this is to notify you that you will be accrued to our union, and you will be a member based on, but it was very kind of legalistic letter to hundreds of people, and I don't know whether they said you will start paying dues or anything, but certainly that was there between the lines, and people just went nuts. People came into my office, you know, sort of waving their letter because they knew that I was active in the union, and they were, what does this mean? Aren't we supposed to vote on this? I mean, they sort of knew the 101s. You know, they saw the movie Norma Rae or whatever it is. You know, So what happened then? The administration said, well, this is a tremendous opportunity for us to protect our people against the union. I mean, a lot of people called HR and said, what's going on? HR said, I don't know what's going on. I mean, we're not responsible for this. I mean, they knew about the whole union clarification thing, but they were going to sort of stand aside and let the unions bash each other's over the head looking for this group and that group. Well, Biddy Martin then sends out a letter. Biddy Martin's the new chancellor, newly appointed at that point. And she sends out a letter saying, we shall protect you. We will not allow these unions to just take away your rights to decide, to choose, you know, sort of those magic words, and just by legal fiat make your union members and force you to pay dues. And I still remember reading the letter on my computer saying, this is of like three worst cases. I hadn't even thought of this one, but this is the other worst case, is we now have pushed everybody into the protective arms of the administration, and there they'll be. And we're the bad guys. It was just incredible. I think the academic staff assembly then called a meeting about, you know, sort of an informational meeting about what's going on. I remember it was in the Armory building and Muggeridge building, and their big hall there, you couldn't fit into it. It was so crowded. It was definitely the biggest gathering of academic staff ever. You know, and out of the whole group, only one person said that they were interested in being a member of the union. Everybody, I mean, who weren't all, you know, just vocally anti-union, most were, but only one person said, well, let me just say, I would like to join you. I don't like what the union did here, but I would like to, you know, join a union. So that was, we never, you know, got them to stop it. So what we did is we said, well, this is just untenable. They're destroying any possibility of having an academic staff union, and also potentially poisoning it for faculty as well. Because faculty knew about this. So we said the thing to do is to split off and sort of decertify ourselves as a have a union election. And we attempted to do that, and that was unsuccessful. You needed 2/3 of the membership.
Two-thirds to vote one way or the other?
Yeah, 2/3 to decertify, to join a different, to okay. Start something else. So that didn't happen. And I and some other people left, and then by that point, Biddy Martin had started her discussion of this public-private partnership program, this new... This was before the 2010 election, so we were in 2010 then, but it was before the election. She met with Barrett and Walker to try to get them on board with, I think, was a not such a veiled attempt to split off the Madison campus. We would have a separate funding stream. We would have a different governance system of some kind. And she, I mean, you were on campus when Biddy was there. She was just a terrific salesperson on this, a really good politician. She gave talks around campus about it, you know, sort of selling the idea, and I went to two of them. And they were almost all academic staff at these things. And I always sat in the front row because I wanted to watch what people's reactions were as she talked. And she always said the same thing about, because of the state personnel system and the classification system, the UW system is really encumbered from giving people the kinds of raises, you know, recognizing what those classifications were and giving people the kind of raises that they deserve. And that's the point where I always turn around and watch people. And you'd see a whole crowd of people individually, but collectively, nod their heads. Yes, she's talking about me. And we think that we should, you know, people deserve more money, especially those people who are working, you know, in an unusual capacity or at some exceptional and outstanding capacity, and everybody would be shaking their heads. That certainly they were the, she, you know, I am the one that she's really has in mind here. you know, we have, you know, sort of 95% of people thinking they're above average. And so she worked that quite a bit. And all the other aspects of what might happen should we stand alone kind of faded. You know, I mean, people were not as, of course, interested in all as that, as the equity that they'll gain once, you know, we get our right to be free of this kind of substandard other campus partners. I mean, it really played a lot on the flagship talk, you know, and our sense of being exceptional, a international campus of renown. We're not like, you know, Platteville, you know, and we shouldn't be treated like Platteville and Oshkosh, you know, sort of the exceptionalism. Let me end it there. Yeah. I've got to run along.
Yep.
And
so, David, I want to thank you for your time today. Okay. Appreciate it. Okay, today is February 11th, 2014. This is the third interview with David Ahrens. Again, we are here in the Madison City County Building. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. David, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
David Ahrens, A-H-R-E-N-S.
Okay, looks like it's going to pick you up just fine. I may have to project a little bit to make sure the questions get on the record, too.
Mm-hmm.
As I said before I turn this on, I got a couple of follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first is, it appears you started to become active again in labor-ish issues, you know, in 2005 with academic staff. So I'm wondering if your interest in public health issues was ebbing enough that you felt like you wanted to become involved in other things. So basically, were you still involved in
public health stuff?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could just take me through, however brief or not so brief you want, your sort of your occupational history on campus then between that second big grant.
Oh, I was still managing a what we called the Tobacco Surveillance and Evaluation Program.
Okay.
The program, though, from 2007 to 2011 shrunk every year. Both the program that we were evaluating and our work continued to shrink and shrink and shrink until it disappeared.
Is that because you were doing so well? Or?
No, it's just political.
Okay.
Yeah, it's purely political.
Okay. So then just to confirm, you were on campus, you were still doing public health work as your paid job on campus.
Right, okay. Right. And actually in about 2009, I also started to work in other epidemiology work, particularly on county rankings, it's called, ranking counties by public health inputs and what their outcomes are. So I started working with different counties on those projects, particularly the poorer rural counties in the state. So that, you know, sort of broadened my work in terms of traveling and, again, and meeting with people who were very much outside of Madison, you know, really outside of Madison.
And were you still, when you were traveling, were you still stationed inside Wharf?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when you would travel, what sort of things would you be doing with these counties?
Oh, just meeting, you know, traveling to the counties and meeting with them, meeting with local health department officials and coaching them in terms of different interventions, sort of low-risk, low-cost interventions they could do in public health. Whether that would be things like one thing was food fairs. Another thing was working with health officials to get better public health or primary health care services for migrant workers. Youth, some pregnancy prevention, which is becomes very political, but it was the first time. I mean, I started working with some counties on, which is kind of it's a very popular topic now, but at the time it was kind of unheard of, which was the issue of bullying. And how, you know, encourage some schools to do surveys, and you know, you had significant parts of populations who were afraid and disturbed to come to school because of bullies, and it, you know, interfered with their social, academic, and personal life. Anyway, so those kinds of issues were what I. Some of the things I worked on.
Okay. Maybe another follow-up to that. Coming into these rural counties as a UW-Madison person, yeah. how were you
warily.
Treated?
Very warily.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not popular. One time I called and... said, but we would like to see what we could do to help you, blah, blah, blah. And the public health officer cut me off and said, if you want to help me, you can drive up here right now with a pickup truck and a shovel and pick up, go on County XY and pick up that dead skunk that's rotting on the road. And, okay. Well, we'll be in touch.
You cross that county off your list.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, some of these counties, I mean, public health is the last thing in the world that the county's interested in. The state has the lowest per capita public health expenditure of any state in the United States. And counties reflect that. Some counties spend almost nothing on it. Except what they absolutely have to do to prevent disease outbreaks. And so the idea for many of these folks, and they're all women, I was going to say all for these women, is to put another thing on her plate? You got to be kidding, you know. So, I mean, they do disease outbreaks, they have to check the water in 150 tourist resort swimming pools, they have to, you know, rashes, poison water wells, I mean, water's a real issue, migrant workers, on and on and on and on. I mean, the list is long, in addition to attempting to do anything at all in prevention, whether that's, you know, smoking, drinking, obesity rates, which are skyrocketing, you know, and so on. These are the 10 poorest rural counties. They were just really challenged. Really challenged. I mean, anything that they're hardworking. I mean, they all just really have their hearts in it, and they hire people who are extremely dedicated but under resourced. Yeah,
tissue?
I do. Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm kind of cold.
There you go.
I'm really sensitive about. So just to get back to the main thing. So I think we left off. Do you have any other questions?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And then we can.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have talked to some people who have been academic staff assembly members, but I've never really asked what an academic staff assembly meeting
is like. I wonder if you could just sort of give me, you know, either specifics about a specific or just sort of some idea of how.
Well, the first question about an academic staff assembly meeting always is, do we have a quorum?
So if there were a quorum.
If there is a quorum.
Then what would happen after that?
Then there might be discussion of what always struck me as being fairly minutia of a policy or a study committee or participation in some work group. And that's it. I mean, the provost would give a sort of a management report about what's happening in school and administration. The chair of the academic staff assembly would give a presentation about the meetings that she went to, and then there would be presentations by an awards committee, a policies and procedures committee, you know, sort of standing committees, and that would be about it. Yeah.
And just to confirm, you were on academic staff assembly before the collective bargaining.
Oh, sure, right.
So at that point, you were on UFAS, right? When that.
Right.
Or you decided to become a part of UFAS once a collective
bargaining bill passed.
Okay.
Right. All right.
I think we got that.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure we have that. So I think when we last left off, we were talking a little bit about the New Badger Partnership.
Yeah.
Sort of the pre-2010 election version of the New Badger Partnership.
Right. Right.
So I don't know if you want to. I might give you space to comment on that as we go along.
Yeah. Well, I think it was very, very well received on campus. I think there was nothing real. I mean, it was so much. It was so vague that it was difficult to really be critical of it in any substantive way. You know, greater autonomy, and we'll be raising a lot of money. And it, I mean, one thing is that it correctly, it was premised on the notion, and I don't know whether Martin actually explicitly said this, but it was premised on the notion. One premise was the days of 25% funding from the state government, that's over. And we're on decline. It's a trend, and there's only one way that this is going, and that's down. And it may take 30 years to get there to zero, but that's the only direction that we're going, and we've got to find our own way. Or we're going, and part of that is let's capitalize on our brand and work it, you know, and we'll benefit, and the real stars here will benefit from it, and that will carry the whole campus forward. And it's, you know, it's very much premised on this, you know, kind of international research university notion. I mean, there's sort of lip service to undergraduate education, but it's really
that's not what the partnership plan was about. It was the brand. And of course, as we move further and further away from state funding as being really critical, what we do with undergraduate education becomes less important. Mm-hmm. There's such a mutual dislike between legislature and the university for many years, and where the university feels, gee, you pay 18% of our baggage and you want 100%, 51% of the say. Mm-hmm. And, where do you get off? And the state says, well, we're still a majority holder at 18%. And second, we built the place. And this is something for people who say, well, we should, we had Catherine Lyle, who was the president of the university in the 90s, and she was always floating this privatization thing. And I said, well, that's a great idea. If you could come up with someone to pay the state back $5-10 billion for the buildings, for the plant, that would be great. But I don't think the state's going to gift it to a private university. So that was sort of Martin's thing, and she floated it with Barrett and Walker, said that they both seemed to be enthusiastic about it, and really, on its face, why shouldn't they be? Because it's essentially saying less money to UW-Madison. So it'd be a big cost savings. It's a lot of headaches, and so on. Well, the one part of the plan is a new HR system. And so the vice chancellor, Darryl Bazell, started a work group called the HR Design Group. And it was all the unions and different academic staff, classified staff, and some personnel officers started meeting and developing a new personnel policy for this for us. And it was going to be the big new thing. And we met a lot. Did lots of paper, lots of discussions, met every Friday for 3 or 4 hours, and with work groups and so on. And there was faculty there too. And it was a good working group. We had a lot of faculty support. The person who was then the chair of the faculty senate, Judith, I can't remember her last name, she was a chemistry professor, was very good and really developed a leadership role in the group, not by virtue of her faculty status, which tends to be a negative in a group like that, but she sort of overcame that fact and really by being intelligent and group intelligent and understanding and being articulate, she sort of became a real leader there. We had the election, and that was a shock. But then came the budget emergency bill, and before that, the people on the committee were the heads of the what's called the blue collar unit and the clerical unit of AFSCME, and I remember talking, and I know the guy who was the head of the clerical unit for when I was a graduate student. I mean, after 35 years, I know him. And said, you know, Gary, you could lose dues deduction. We could all lose the dues deduction. In this, it's and his view was, it was really unthinkable, you know. I said, you know, you really, there was a, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a policy magazine that comes out of Milwaukee, and it's a conservative policy magazine, I can't remember, is it McIver, maybe from McIver Institute. And so in the months leading up to the election and afterwards, each month would be sort of what's the conservative agenda. I remember reading the one on UW, and it was on collective bargaining, and it's saying, well, absolutely we have to repeal the collective bargaining for faculty and academic staff. I mean, that goes without saying. And then I ran into this Republican lobbyist this was shortly after the election, and a guy I knew and from years back, I am friendly with some Republicans, and he said, "Are you still at UW?" "Yeah." And he said, "You're still doing?" Yeah. He said, "You're fucked." He said, "That's the one thing that's top of their hit parade is they're going to repeal your ass." And oops.
So then you had a pretty good idea it was coming before.
Yeah, I had an idea. I knew that the repeal was coming. But I didn't know about the rest of Act 10. I didn't know they were going to repeal everybody's collective bargaining. I thought they were going to repeal the academic staff and faculty. And I thought they would roll back all the mediation arbitration provisions for local employees. And, you know, curb this, do that. And I thought, well, they might go the full boat. I mean, I raised this with AFSCME of that the dues deduction might go. And, well, so it happened. The problem that then happened with the Badger Partnership was it just became submerged in this whole morass of, if it's Walker, then it's, of course, completely beyond suspect. I mean, it's... then it has to be rejected on its face. And the real aspect of it was is that UW would become this public authority. And who would appoint members of the public authority? Well, of course, it's going to be Walker. And the script that I was telling people was he can't wait till he gets a majority of the regents. He wants to do it all now. He's just going to strip out the flagship and appoint his people as directors of it. And so that coupled with... The other thing is that the HR design was based on continuing a union management relationship. Well, really, the whole foundation of it then just the bottom of the bucket fell out. We now were not dealing with that. We were dealing with potentially these very lopsided kinds of power relationships. These weren't relationships based on equity anymore. These are relationships based on all real power being vested in the employer. So that discussion, the nature of that discussion really changed. I mean, the people who were at the union before, and they weren't. I mean, they had some power at the table as those discussions began before. But by the end, all the demonstrations were over. Everything was sort of over. The law had been passed. They knew that in July 1, they were not going to have dues deduction and really no collective bargaining authority. The employer was not going to recognize them.
So if you don't mind, get into maybe some specific, your specific memories about what went on. We already talked about the budget repair bill.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you recall, not specifically where you were, but just sort of in general where you were.
Well, one of the things that happened was the first day of the demonstrations, really. You know this from talking to TAAs. So the TAAs were part of the committee, the HR committee. And I remember the head of the TAAs had the, you know, about these postcards, I Heart UW. Mm-hmm. So he wanted everybody to sign these I Heart UW postcards. And they were going to give it to the governor. And I thought, well, yeah, that's good. Yeah. That'll work. And so we all signed them, and they went up there, and I mean, what did they have, like 100 people or something, go up on the first day, and dropped off a lot of the postcards, and heard about it, and met with this guy, you know, Rob, what's his last name? Mm-hmm. He was like the staff person for the TA. Rob Henn. And so he was on our committee, the HR committee. Mm-hmm. And so I saw him the next day, and he said it was great, and they were going back the next day and to, you know, talk about, demonstrate against the overall collective bargaining bill. And then it all rolled from there. I mean, the next day there were a few hundred people, and third day there were, when I came, it was, you know, a few thousand people. Mm-hmm. So it was just, you know, were you there?
I went one day.
Okay. So it was staggering. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, it was very heartening. But I think I had such a sense of anxiety often about what happens next, and that that it was such an extraordinary event. As weeks went on, you know, 200,000 people, whatever the numbers were, just biggest groups of people ever, that people were so caught up in this moment, mm-hmm. that it was impossible to think strategically down the line a little, other than the one thing which people kept saying, well, we'll vote you out, and the recall thing. And and
my view was that we need more than one strategy here. And it's a long time to get from X to Y and other aspects of this. I tried to, I worked on trying to keep having campus-based protests in terms of marching up the street and stuff like that. But I really felt that campus was just rather oblivious to it. And it's very odd way. I remember we said was downtown every day, and we're coming back on a Friday, and I came back to my office for a few hours, and I'd been away for 2 days, downtown, and everybody was like, nothing was going on. Mm-hmm. and what was going on, was, I thought, so important to campus, but, people didn't share that, and, maybe it's not true. Maybe I was wrong. So,
I think you just said it yourself. So after about day three, you started going down.
Yeah, on day three.
Every day.
Yeah.
There are pictures and video about what the inside of the Capitol looked like, but as a person actually in there, is there a way you can describe what the Capitol was like during those days?
Oh, it was, I really didn't like it. I don't like big, very claustrophobic crowds and the whole drumming thing, and I'm an old guy who... The idea of someone, drum choruses or whatever they're called, are just really distasteful. It was this communard kind of feeling to it, and people sleeping there, and banners and boards all over on this and that. I was really surprised that the administration tolerated it. But it sort of played out, and that's what happened to the demonstration. It just sort of played out, and they just waited it out. Mm-hmm. Do as little as possible and just wait it out.
Is that your, and it might be tough to, sort of what your idea was at the time and what your idea was now, but I guess I would call it the tactic of the Democratic senators, the Wisconsin 14, leaving the state. In your mind, did you feel that was, all that was doing was just postponing the inevitable?
Oh, no, that was good. That was good. I mean, kept the debate going. I mean, otherwise they just would have slammed this through and overnight, and that, then all the air would have been out of the tire, and we've had nothing going on. Things like civil disobedience. I mean, I thought, why don't we... stop our cars on the Beltline. On the interstate. Or go 45 miles an hour. Whatever it is. Maybe you can't stop because that would cause an accident. But the drive 42 miles an hour. And just
I'm old school, so it's sort of like you've got to show people that this hurts, and that this is really important. And going downtown and having this exultant party for 2 weeks sort of doesn't translate into like we're going to pay a price for this, because we are going to pay a price for this. So we've got to put ourselves on the line. I mean, this is, if we're sincere about and really believe that these are really important rights that are being taken away, and people are going to be losing 10-15% of their incomes as a result of this for nothing but political purposes, and smashing up nothing but an attempt to destroy the political opposition, which is what it's really about, then we've got to oppose it in something other than, you know, balloons and drums and marching around. So
you alluded to the recalls earlier too. So mm-hmm. How did you feel about those? I know you said that there needed to be more than just sort of more long-term thought than just recall, but what about the idea of recalling not only the governor but some of the senators?
Oh, I was for that. Yeah, I worked hard on that. I mean, I did calls and walked around some districts and did that.
Did you, I mean, obviously in the end it worked for some of the senators, but it really, now we're back to a point where the Senate is controlled by
Republicans. Yeah, I think we knew, I think a lot of people could sort of count the where things were going before that, how things were going to turn out. That we weren't going to, if we won the Senate, it wasn't going to be for long.
And what about the recall of the governor? Did you feel
confident? I think people were blown away by that. And emotionally, really blown away by it.
By the fact that he wasn't recalled?
That he wasn't recalled, yeah. Shortly after the recall, I managed Obama's campaign on this east side area here. So I chaired the committee here.
Right.
And
so you're pointing to a map that's basically like east of Lake Monona.
Yeah. To the
and then a bit to the north of Lake Monona.
Yeah. The east side. It's not the near east side, it's the east side. And so it's four council districts. And so the campaign began before the recall, of course, which was 12. And these are people from the Obama campaign, and I told them that there's no, you cannot get any activity for the, I mean, these people sort of parachute in. And say, well, can you organize for the Obama campaign? And say, well, don't you know we're recalling the government? Yeah, but how about Obama? And I, well, where, have you read the paper? So they sort of caught on to that. The only way to get the Obama campaign organized was to get volunteers together and work on these other campaigns, or at least just wait it out. Mm-hmm. But the point is that after the recall campaign failed, after we lost, we couldn't get anybody to work on the Obama campaign.
it really took months. People were so disheartened. I mean, the thing is, I mean, we had many more signatures than we had votes. So we didn't get all of the people who signed to the polls. I mean, there were so many, you know, 1.1 million petitions, and people said, well, that's in the back, you know. Well, these people signed, and there's got to be some people who didn't sign, but who'll vote. Well, it turned out to be the opposite. A lot of people who signed just signed because someone asked them to sign. and I saw it myself. I mean, I would, you know, stand in the Woodman's parking lot, and people would pull in. I'd say, you'd like to sign the recall petition. And one person would say, yeah. And then the other people would say, and then they would say to the other people in the car, oh, you sign too. And they'd pass it around, everybody would sign. Well, that's all it was. Mm-hmm. So, it was quite a staggering hit. There was really, other than the TAs and some graduate students, I didn't sense a high level of participation from UW. I mean, just looked at the crowds. I mean, just looked at them. And it just wasn't college students there. On two times, I worked with groups to get people together at Library Mall and march up State Street. And it was maybe 1,000 people or something. Really not the kind of support that you'd expect. I mean, we had more people coming from like West High. Mm-hmm. I mean, West High had a walkout. East High had a walkout. I mean, they, you know, you could look up and down East Wash and you'd see, you know, 1,500 students from East High come down the street. So that was much, you know, that was really kind of disappointing. That, mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, because we have just 10 minutes left. And I think this is probably going to be our last session, mm-hmm. so there's a couple of things I want to make sure we get on the record. And so the first off is why retire from UW when you did?
Mm-hmm. I lost funding. We lost all our funding at the end. So about 2011. We just, the Walker administration just zeroed us out. So, and I was able to retire. So
you'd had enough time.
Yeah. Yeah, time and age.
So, I mean, it's easy in hindsight. This is now 2014. But if the funds would have continued, do you think you would still be on campus?
I don't think I'd still be there now. I might have stayed not much longer, really. I might have stayed another year.
Okay. So the other thing I want to make sure we get on the record is, then, you know, you're now an alderman, alderperson for the city of Madison. So why did that become something you wanted to do?
I really
had no political aspirations at all, oddly enough. I mean, went through the recall campaign and the Obama campaign, and I heard that the alder for our district was not going to run again, and I asked literally three people, I mean, not just asked, but seriously sat down with them and said, I'll run your campaign. Run. And I'll run it. And all of them said no. One guy said, well, if you could get me appointed and I don't have to run at all, I'll do it. But I don't want to run at all. So, well, that really doesn't work like that. You really have to do something. That's the price of admission, pal. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't get any of the people who I were, you know, I politically respected, capable, had the time, and so on. None of them wanted to do it. And then I was really kind of didn't think any more of it. And then two of them said, came to my house and said, you know, we were thinking about it, and said, why don't you run? And I'd been involved with politics for a very long time, and I'd always had this notion of, I absolutely do not want to run as a candidate. I'll be happy to run other people, but I don't want to run as a candidate. And I didn't particularly, wasn't interested in being in a governing body or anything. And and thought about it and said, yeah, this could be worthwhile. I had not been involved very much with city politics. So I came to that with kind of a fresh view. And then I was very fortunate in that, because I had run these other campaigns, I had a good group of volunteers who knew me, who worked with me, and who were ready, really, the week after the Obama campaign ended to start meeting with me and start the whole thing over again. And then I did. I had an opponent, you know, substantive opponent, and won. But it took it's a lot of work. It was, mm-hmm. I campaigned throughout from December 1 to April, whatever it was, 5th. I campaigned every day except for 2 days. You know, talk to, you know, thousands of people and so on. It's quite a role. And so I've really enjoyed it. I mean, after a while, I started accepting my role as a candidate. It was very hard for me to say vote for me. I'd spent years saying vote for somebody else. But saying vote for me, because I'm special, was a real threshold issue for me to cross. And even worse was the issue of asking people for money. That was very hard. All that aside, it's been very gratifying, very interesting work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to give you space again. You know, we got a couple minutes here for some final thoughts. You know, I came to talk to you about the 2011 protests, mm-hmm. but
we covered a lot of other ground,
labor issues, mm-hmm. politics. And I just want to make sure if there's anything on your mind, you know, either looking back or maybe looking ahead that you want to get on the record? I want to give you space to do that.
Well, I mean, just to get back to it again about the leadership of the protests, which were, of course, you know, AFSCME unions and WEAC. Just was so dependent on the bag of the trick, the one thing that they had in their bag of tricks. They have one thing. Let's go to elections. And if it was, and everything gets played from there. I mean, you could see that by the fact of how slow they were even to catch on to the demonstrations themselves. They couldn't imagine that there would be a real outpouring of this, of, you know, of popular rage and disgust. And at this, they didn't show up for a week. And then it became, you know, very kind of stage managed and so on. But to roll the whole thing on, we're either going to do it electorally, and, you know, I'm not, you know, there were some people who were, oh, let's have a general strike, blah, 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 blah. I thought that was nonsense. I mean, that just... You know, here's an anecdote that was really shook me up. This was well after it was over. I was having lunch with a history professor, labor history professor, who's currently at UW, And this, I forget his name, he's the dean of the business school, came over, and he's French, and he's a French import. And so he came over, and he was in France during the height of the demonstrations. And he said, you know, you guys... I talked to my labor friends, and we watched your demonstrations. I watched my demonstrations with some of my labor friends, and this guy, believe me, is no labor guy. I mean, he's the dean of the business school. and he said, I don't get it. They say, why do they just go round and round and round and round and round? And that's all they do? And so the notion was, why didn't they... I mean, were the unions so depleted of solidarity and force that they couldn't shut down Madison? They shut down Madison schools for 2 days. But why weren't there strikes all in every school district? Or most of them? Or 2 days in Green Bay, or the highway department in Racine County, and then the courthouse in Sheboygan. They were unable to do, not to go out on strike permanently, but it's the, I mean, they do this in many countries, which is, it's the rolling strike, and it hurts the employees the least because you're only out for a day. And the real margin of it is that it doesn't really hurt people as much as it's incredibly inconvenient. It causes a lot of inconvenience for people. So it's not really a punch in the jaw or something where, gee, your kids are out of school for 2 weeks and it absolutely disrupts your life, you know. This is, gee, they're out of school for 2 days, and somebody's got to stay home or do something for 2 days. But it really gets people noticing what's the problem here. Why are these people doing it? And it causes some discussion and kind of forces the hand, you know, well, government, what are you going to do about it? Maybe this thing is so bad that you shouldn't have done it. And that's the thing that Walker was running against, really. I mean, that was the jibe against him, was he really wasn't very nice. I mean, for sort of the middling ground people, it was, people shouldn't behave like that. We should have discussions with people. Both sides should play fair and reach some middle ground. Some of the union stuff should have been rolled back. We should have paid something on the retirement, should have paid something on the health insurance. But no unions? That seems extreme. But the unions really never forced the issue. They only wanted to play within a very, very narrow comfort zone, where they, you know, have gotten good at. You know, you hire consultants, you raise a few million dollars, you have your, you know, sort of core group of activists, and, you know, it's a core group of 5% or 10% of members who are, really respond to, you know, calls for political activity. But the thing of, can we really get people to get into the base here? And can we get the Kenosha highway workers to walk out for 2 days? That would have been a challenge, but I think it would have made a whole different outcome. A whole different outcome. And then even to, at the same time, raise the stakes a little more. You know, have civil disobedience. Just inconvenience people. Just get people, you know, and you inconvenience people, you get some people pissed off, for sure. But a lot of people who were in the margins, who were in the center, I should say, will scratch their heads and say, why are they that angry about this? This must be a really bad thing. So that was my anxiety during it. I mean, I felt very jubilant, and it was all very dreamlike during it, but I also felt like only playing one card is a dangerous game to play. And I'm sure there were a lot of the unions felt, we really got no other card. Really can't do it. But I think they underestimated the members. I think that with some coaching and some organizing, they could have done it. It just would have been risky. You know, legal fees, blah, 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 blah. You know, it would have been risky. But I mean, the risk of not doing it was obviously huge because they lost.
Well, David, we've gone past our allotted time. I thank you for all the time you've given me.
Yeah, enjoyed it.
And this concludes the Oral History with David Ahrens. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Troy.